This is our second study in the book of Numbers. All right. I'll check that next time. All right. Remember about putting your trust in man. Okay. So when we look at this book, we look at the chronological outset of this book, we are not dealing with a fixed chronological set of events in that we finish the book of Exodus, then we have all this time where Moses sat and carefully recorded the book of Leviticus and a little bit of events that took place in the book of Leviticus, and then we get into the book of Numbers. When we end with the book of Exodus, we have the tent already set up. And then tonight, when we start looking at chapter 7, the tent, he makes reference to about a past event and some things that had already taken place. Because when we read in the very beginning of the book of Numbers, we are at the second month. And so by the time we're opening up with the book of Numbers, the tent of meeting has already been set up for a month at least. All right, so with Hebrew narrative, it is not straight linear kind of tale of events. We'll go up to a certain section, and then we'll go back and talk about something else that happened, or it'll be thematic, and the narrative will be arranged based on certain themes. And so if they give you dates, pay attention to the dates, right? If you've read Tolkien stuff before, it gets confusing. So you got to make sure you're covering those kind of things. So that's a word of note as we open up chapter 7 and are looking at a few things. So we've been talking about this outline that we're using for this working outline. In the first 9 chapters, the Israelites are preparing for their trek, for their journey, where they're supposed to go into the promised land, right? So that's what they're preparing for. And had all things gone well, then they would have gone marched right into the promised land, and the book of Numbers would have been much shorter. And maybe a briefer Deuteronomy, but that is not at all what happened. And so we'll be finishing up this section and then the second section as well. But if we look at chapter 7, it opens up, "Now on the day that Moses had finished setting up the tabernacle, he anointed it and consecrated it." This goes back to Exodus chapter 39 and Exodus chapter 40, if you want a detailed scene that took place and unfolded there with the water and the oil and the anointing and all those kind of things that took place. And he anointed, and then all the utensils and everything were consecrated at that time. What was not mentioned then is what he begins to mention now, is that the leaders of Israel and the heads of their fathers and households made an offering, and we get to see that offering now, the consecration of the tabernacle, and there's also some carts. Remember we talked about the different families, the Levitical families, subfamilies, that were going to be carrying all the paraphernalia with the temple and all that kind of stuff? Well, guess what? They get carts, all right? This is where they get their carts. And the families donated, the tribes donated the carts for this, the oxen and the carts for it, and they were able to use those to carry everything. Now, this is an open book, all right? This is an open book. You can look at this chapter. I'm going to quiz you. We talked about one family. I'm not going to ask you which family. I won't quiz you that much. But there are basically three groups of those that are carrying things. What one group is going to be carrying what? Do you remember? How was the tabernacle and on all of its pertinences divided up? Do you remember? What's that? So you had the curtains and the draperies and all that kind of stuff, right? All the fabrics and those porpoise skins and all that, poor porpoises, all those things, right? That were folded up, that was one thing. And then you had the skeleton, right? The tabernacle skeleton, the wood, the lumber, and the sockets, and all that kind of stuff, which for me, if you've ever had played with Kinex, Legos, anyway, that's for me what it looks like. And then you have what else? What's left? What's that? The furnishings, all the high and holy things, right? And those were a certain family supposed to carry those. Now, there were carts that were given to the families that were going to be carrying all the fabrics, and there were carts that were given to the families that were going to be carrying all the skeleton structure, basically, of the tabernacle, but the other family didn't get any carts. Why? How were they supposed to carry the high and holy things? The poles of shittim wood, right? Covered in gold. And so those were the things that were, that they put the poles through those things with the drapery over them, and they carried them, they ported them that way. And so when, just fast forward hundreds of years, and David is thinking, how are we going to move the holy things? Was it a random coincidence that he thought, well, let's put it on a cart? Maybe he just read Numbers. I don't know what he was, maybe he just lost his mind, forgot about the fact that they had the little poles and they had the rings and they had all that kind of stuff. But he made new carts, like they made a new cart to carry it. And maybe it was easier, I don't know. But maybe this is where he got that idea. He should have kept reading correctly. But anyway, I digress. So that gives you an idea of what's going on. And so they offered two carts, they offered carts there for those things. And then we have a dedication for the altar. And in this dedication, this is a rather long chapter. We're not reading it. We're not going through all of it. But there are 12 days in succession where every family gives an offering for the dedication of the altar and for the things that are going to be, utensils are going to be used in the use of the altar. And so every family, all tribes, every tribe, is going to be, they're going to be giving these items on these days. And so you have the items that are there for the one offering, and then you have for the peace offering, a second. And so every tribe gives these items. Now look at these dishes, ladies and gentlemen. So they have these silver dishes that are there, and they give the weight in shekels. And I've given you, according to today's value of silver and gold, what those things that would have been worth. I don't have today's value on beef and goat and that kind of stuff, so I don't know what the value of those things are going to be. But at least on these items, are we talking about things that were expensive? Yes. Were they expensive even then? Yes, they were expensive. And so these things were given at that time. And so these were used in the temple worship and their sacrifices and that kind of stuff. And so every tribe had the responsibility of donating these items that were going to be used and consecrated for that work. And so this long chapter goes through and talks about they're very thorough in making sure every family is represented in every family. Even at the end of the chapter, it gives you the total of all the things in case you needed the math on that and everything that was happening. So that gives you an idea of what's going on with this chapter. Now, in verse 89, let's fast forward to chapter 7, verse 89. There's a little addendum here at the end of this chapter. It says, now when Moses went into the tent of the meeting to speak with him, capital H, the Lord, he heard the voice speaking to him from above the mercy seat that was on the Ark of Testimony from between the two cherubim, so he spoke to him. There's just a note there about God's method of one of God's methods for speaking with Moses. I find that interesting. It's kind of added on here at the end of chapter 7. So we have this. And again, this is all in that first month of the year when these things take place. And then in verse 8, it says, then the Lord spoke to Moses, or chapter 8, verse 1, speak to Aaron and to him, saying, when you mount the lamp. So we're given more instruction about just how you organize things inside the temple, the tabernacle. And we're given some information here about the lamp. And what's interesting here in verse 4, or again, this concept that this was made of hammered work according to the pattern which the Lord had shown Moses, so he made the lampstand. Why is it important that it's hammered work? I don't know if you've ever seen castings where they do this with rings, they do this with most things, where you carve a casting and you get it ready and then you pour the molten material in. That's one way of doing it. This was hammered out work. This was not done with casting. And so in order for them to form these things, they're hammering it out carefully, heating it up, quenching it, making it soft again, hammering it out soft again, because gold, like other non-ferrous metals, will harden if you keep hammering it and keep hammering it and keep hammering it. It'll get brittle and break. So you got this careful process of hammering out these items, very, very detailed work. And so God specified not only what he wanted, but how it was to be made according to the pattern that I showed you. So fast forward again into New Testament times when the word pattern is used in the New Testament, and we're given a pattern for worship, we're given a pattern for how we use. That should make us feel all warm and fuzzy inside when we see that information. Yes?
So being, I know it's not just worship, but being hammered, you're saying that it's solid, not overlaid?
For the lamp, yes, it's solid. Mm-hmm. Yep. According to what, so the lamp was a solid piece of metal. The overlay was with the wood and that kind of stuff. That was overlaid with gold. But again, the only reason I share that with you is like it's detailed work, ladies and gentlemen. This is not something that, and again, they're out in the desert, in the middle of the desert, doing this type of work. It's not like they're in the tool shops and that kind of stuff. Where they would normally have been doing these kind of things. So it speaks to the length that God is, even now, even in these circumstances, this is what I expect out of you, and it's going to be maybe difficult. Chapter or verse 5, here, the cleansing of the Levites, 5 through 13. We have this again. They're supposed to do this cleansing process. Look at what they have to do in verse 7. Thus you shall do to them, to their cleansing, sprinkle purifying water on them. Let them use a razor over their whole body and wash their clothes, and they'll be clean. This is for the Levites who are going to go into this service for the temple, this purification process. And they're presenting the Levites for the tent of the meeting, the assembly of the whole congregation, and there were used. Now, verse 11, Aaron then shall present the Levites before the Lord as a wave offering from the sons of Israel, that they may qualify to perform the service of the Lord. You don't just, because your last name is Levite, you just walk up in there and do this thing. There's certain people who have gone through certain qualifications in order to be able to serve God in this way. And they are shown as a wave offering. It's kind of passed in front. If you want to think of a wave offering as a king who is like, people come to a king and show them their gifts they've presented to the king and just kind of show it before the king, and the king goes ooh and ah as you pass by. That's kind of what we're looking at here with a wave-type offering. Look at what happens with this concept of all of Israel playing a part. What happened in verses 12 and 13 that they all played a part in this process? The Levites shall lay their hands on the heads of the bulls and offer for a sin offering. Where is it? Okay. Where did I miss? I missed. I'm out of. Okay, I guess I'm out of order here on when they're laying their hands on, but the tribe itself also lays their hands on the Levites, as though they're the ones going into the service. Here we have this, the Levites are separated for the work that they're supposed to be doing. They're set apart for this holy work that they're going to be doing in order to serve the Lord. And verse 20, thus did Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the sons of Israel to the Levites according to all the Lord had commanded Moses concerning the Levites to the sons of God. And so verse 10, yes, there it is. And presented the Levites before the Lord, and the sons of Israel shall lay their hands on the Levites. And so there is this kind of a passing of responsibility to the Levites, or taking on this work that God has given them to do. And Israel's recognizing that these people are the ones that are set apart for this. And again, we see that with the offering as well. But this concept of laying on hands is throughout the Bible in a partaking of responsibility. It's what's done with a kind of assuming responsibility of those that are of the sacrifice. When you lay the hand on the sacrifice, that is passing, you know, to them and those kind of things. So it's interesting here, this element that is mentioned that God had them do. But they did according to everything that they were supposed to do. The Levites, verse 21 of chapter 8, the Levites also purified themselves from the sin and washed their clothes. And again, they're doing this purification system, and it was what God has commanded them to do. We have a word here about retirement of service, and about we talked about from 30 to 50 is when their time frame for those who are working in the temple. But it seems like there may be apprenticeship, as though he talks here about 25. Those can go up at the age of 25. and so it's interesting here that this information is given to us, but recorded for future generations for them to understand the Levites and their service. Chapter 9 is a big chapter. Here we are with the Passover. The Passover is kind of marks a changing of the year on the 14th day of the month. And so the temple was set up on the first day of the first month, and here we are at the 14th day of the first month to observe the Passover, and they're going to do this Passover. You're supposed to do it according to what they were taught, and we have some interesting kind of information here about the Passover. Some questions kind of come up. In verse 6, it says, "But there were some men who were unclean because of a dead person, so they could not observe the Passover on that day. So they came before Moses and Aaron on that day, and the men said to him, 'Though we were unclean because of the dead person, why are we restrained from presenting the offering of the Lord as was appointed the time among the sons of Israel?' And so they wait and they go and talk to God about it. And God says this in verse 10, 'Speak to the sons of Israel, saying, if any one of you or your generations becomes unclean because of a dead person or is on a distant journey, or may, however, observe the Passover of the Lord in the second month on the 14th day.'" So basically at twilight. So basically you wait a month in order to partake or do the Passover. So they're unclean, and they must stay outside of the camp for 7 days because of their uncleanliness. And so they wait for that time period. They give you a month, and then you do it again on the next month. And so this becomes a statute for future generations. So this statute was enacted here. And so we have this information. It says, verse 13, "But the man who is clean and is not on a journey and yet neglects to observe the Passover, that person shall then be cut off from his people, for he did not present the offering of the Lord at the appointed time. That man shall bear his sins." When there's an appointed time to be somewhere in the worshiping of the Lord in a certain context, did God think it was serious?
Right.
Kind of did. Does that have any bearing on today? Maybe, right? It's a habit of some is. So this is interesting here also in verse 14. "If an alien sojourns against you," this is, you know, foreigner, not gray man, big eyes, "is sojourning among you and observes the Passover of the Lord according to the statute of the Passover and according to his ordinance, so he shall do, and you shall have one statute." So that is to say that there is one law that governs all peoples. All right, that's very nice, right, when it does that. What is not mentioned here, Exodus 12:48 says that if they observe the Passover with you, they must be circumcised. They have to be circumcised in order to observe the Passover, which is interesting. This kind of concept have led some in the past to practice closed communion. That is, that those who partake of communion on the Lord's Day must be baptized saints. It couldn't be just anybody coming in here and they partake of a cracker and juice whenever they want. Like, only the saints, only those. And we do that because that's our practice in that we pass the trace throughout the aisles. Most people who have no idea what's going on, they don't. If they do partake of it, it's just juice and a cracker to them, right? It doesn't mean anything. But for us, it obviously means something. But This kind of concept is that you, in order to partake of this Passover, you must be circumcised in order to do that. Again, has led others to practice what has been called in the past closed communion. It's not something that's necessarily popular today, but it was something that was practiced in the past. How do you move the GPS system? We've seen the cloud and we've seen the fire, right? Already in the past in the Old Testament. But now this cloud and this fire is going to be over the tabernacle. That's where it's going to rest. That is the Shekinah glory of God that rests over his presence with his people. Instructions given here, way more detail that's needed, but I understand God's dealing with the people that need a lot of detail. But it talks about basically when you see the cloud move, that's the day you move. And it goes into great detail talking about the cloud moves and where it stops, that's where you make camp, that's where you stop, and you don't keep moving. And if you make camp and the cloud has not moved and it's been one day, don't move. And if a cloud has stopped and it's been one week and the cloud has not moved, do not move. You know how repetitive it gets sometimes in the Old Testament, right? So it gets very repetitive there about the instructions about don't move if the cloud hasn't moved. And so this gives them an idea of when they're supposed to be camping and those kind of things. So instructions there about movements for the camp. Chapter 10, we begin a different section here. And we're making ready for travel, and we start traveling. We're starting to move. And we talked about before that there's some instructions about when they move. Were they able to move just whenever, like the cloud starts moving, right? The cloud, we wake up in the morning and the cloud is moving, right? Are you able just to get your family up? So, all right, guys, the cloud's moving. Let's go. First in line. We don't want to be in the dust. Let's get up to the front of the line. Were you able to do that? No, they were not able to do that. So there was a certain order in which they had to make out, break camp and move. And so we're given some instruction about that. Chapter 10 starts off with their signaling process, that there were some silver trumpets that were supposed to be made that when tooted a certain way, that would give them instructions on what they were supposed to do. In my imagination, they were rather large trumpets, right? Now, there wasn't necessarily a lot of other trumpets for them to compete with, right? Like they had like the ska band out there or whatever had playing their trumpets or anything. No, there was silver trumpets. It was probably the only trumpets that were in the area. So when they heard the trumpets, when they were given certain commandments by these trumpets, they were told to break, and the certain ones are supposed to go in certain order, and then we have the order of those that were supposed to be moving based on their orientation around the tabernacle, and the tabernacle was supposed to be moved at a certain time. And based on just the movements, this was a huge... How many of you have tried to keep track of 20 people? Like a classroom, right? That can be daunting at times, right? I can't imagine the troop movements like this without GPS and like walkie-talkies and that kind of stuff to all the different tribes and that kind of thing. Which channel would you be on anyway, right? So it gets insane about that. So here we have trumpets, a simple system. The leaders, obviously, of the different families are supposed to know what was going on. And, I could imagine that it would get crazy. So they move and they leave Sinai. They've been camping in this one place for a year, and in the second year, in the second month, or the 2 years that they're moving, and this cloud is lifted over the tabernacle and testimony, and they move. They set out on the journey of the wilderness, and the wilderness of Paran, which they come back to this wilderness area from time to time. And so it talks about the movements. The tabernacle was broken down, and movements of who went where and when and why, and the tribes moved. verse 29, Moses talks to Hobab, the son of Reuel, or Jethro, right? So son of Jethro means what to Moses? Quiz me quick. This is, Hobab would be Jethro's son-in-law, or rather father-in-law. So I just gave you the answer. Hobab is the a brother-in-law of Moses. And so Moses said to his brother-in-law, hey, why don't you go with us? We're settling in a place where the Lord has said, I will give it to you. In Moses' mind, where they're going. Where are they going in Moses' mind? They're going to the Promised Land. He has no concept of what his life was going to be like in the next 40 years. But we're going. We're going to, and it'll be good for you. It's going to be great. It's going to be great, right? Pass along the blessings. Nepotism is good in some ways, right? But he says, I will go. I will not come, but rather I'll go my own land and my own relatives, which is what his father had done. But then he said, please do not leave us. Inasmuch as you were, you know where we should camp in the wilderness, and you will be eyes for us. And so he gives them this kind of duty of being a scout. And so apparently the cloud moves to an area and I guess doesn't necessarily designate a specific camping spot that they would need a scout, or that's just kind of like a fun little title to make his brother-in-law still come with them. I don't know, but we have this idea of a scout, the eyes for us, and so they go with them. So they set out from the Mount of the Lord and journey with the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, verse 33, journeying in front of them for 3 days to seek out a resting place for them. And the cloud of the Lord was over them by day and when they set out from the camp. And when it came about, verse 35, we have this sort of message here. Whenever the ark is set out, Moses says, rise up, O Lord, and let your enemies be scattered, and let those who hate you flee from you before you. And then when it comes to rest, he says, return, O Lord, to the myriad thousands of Israel. And so this becomes this kind of verbiage that's used whenever the ark leaves and when it comes back to its resting place. It's interesting here. Just all the ceremony that's involved in this process. Chapter 11, we are starting to move now as a people, and we start getting the named places. If you study the Old Testament and Numbers much, that when they name a place, it wasn't always great. Right? So if they went to a place that had already named, or an area that was already named, they did fine there. But if they had to rename that place, it typically wasn't good. Right? And so we start getting in that scenario where we're traveling. Now, the text tells us that how long was this trip to Paran? What was it? How long was it? I'm sorry?
3 days.
How long on your trips as a family is it before somebody echoes from the back, are we there yet? Yeah. We're not even to Fort, so we're not even halfway at 95 yet, and somebody's yelling about it. But look here. Now, the people became like those who complain of adversity. Have you met a complainer? They're super fun to be around, right? It's awesome. And so here we have the complainers. The people start complaining. And so in the hearing of the Lord, so God heard about it. How many parents would have wanted to do this? And the Lord has heard it, and his anger was kindled in the fire, and the Lord burned among them and consumed some of the outskirts of the camp. Consumed, right? Should they be complaining? No. They're going to the Promised Land. These are all things that are supposed to be happening. This is great. Don't be a complainer. Are some adversities going to have to walk a little bit, all right? And then what they complain about. So this place got named Terabah, which means, any guesses? Burning, right. So we're really good with the naming things. Really, really original. And then, verse 4, the rabble who are among them had greedy desires. And also the sons of Israel wept again, saying, who will give us meat to eat? Meh, meh, meh. Right? We remember the fish, which I imagine them the whining. Like, have you heard somebody that whines? Ugh. All right. It is great. It's like fingernails on a chalkboard to me when I hear somebody whining. We remember the fish which we used to eat free in Egypt, the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic and the orangutans and the cereals, and they're listing all these different things, right? All these things that we used to eat. Not orangutans and cereals and stuff. I'm just... That was from Brother Baynard, if you know the reference there. Okay, all right. But now our appetite is gone. There's nothing at all to look at except this manna. So God is providing for them manna from heaven that they must just collect, mill, and bake into cakes, right? Like, you literally don't have to work to do this. Like, easy bake oven kind of thing. And they're complaining. And we get instruction here about the collection of the manna as it was dew that fell on them at night. And then Moses, the people start complaining. Husbands, you've come home from work. You walk in the door. Wife says, guess what your children did today, right? What is Moses saying here? What does he say in this text? Is he like really excited about this? Now Moses heard the people weeping throughout their families, each man at the doorway of his tent, which is just a crazy image. And the anger of the Lord was kindled greatly, and Moses was displeased. So Moses said to God, why have you been so hard on your servant? And why have you not found favor in your sight that you have laid the burden of all this people on me? Now do you think God was kind of thinking in the back of his mind, oh, he has only just begun, Moses, right? You got 40 years of this. You just don't know it yet. But here, this information, he takes this on himself. What is Moses doing? He's whining as well. But why is he whining? Are the people complaining about Moses necessarily? Who are they complaining about? God. Moses is just this, like, in-between guy. And he's making it, what, about himself. Did we do that? Nah, we never do that. We never make things about ourselves. He's not understanding. There are times in our lives where we need to be able just to, people say things and are running their mouths, and it's not about us. And we need to be able to just let it roll off. It's not mine. I don't have any ownership of that. Let's talk to God about it. People complaining to you about things, and they come up to you, and they want to bring you in to whatever they're complaining about. Well, I think they should be doing this, and I think they should be doing this. That's not my gig, right? What do you want to do about it? That should be the question, right? What is your responsibility that you should be doing? Yes, sir. Oh, yeah, it gets better, right? On one occasion, the ground opens up and swallows up people, and then like the next day, they're complaining again. They don't learn very well. But yes, very much so. Like the people just like crispied on the outside, and now they're doing this. So I you know, it doesn't make sense. And it was Moses gets really, really kind of pertinent with God. Was it I who conceived all these people? Was it I who brought them forth that you should say to me, carry them on your boat? So he gets very, very kind of like, I don't know how to be saying that to God, right? I mean, I know he's his friend, but I don't know I would be saying that to God. And he said, here's a keynote. I alone am not able to carry all these people because it's too burdensome for me. What was Moses forgetting? God was the one carrying these people. Moses was just like utilitarian piece out there doing this kind of thing. Moses got things flipped around. Human condition. We still do it, right? We still do that. God responds, right? God says, all right, I heard you. Gather me the 70 men from the elders. You know, all the elders come up. I will come down and speak with you there, and I'll make a spirit who's upon you and be upon them. And so he answers Moses first in that the spirit that was upon Moses, he kind of gives a spirit to the people so they can kind of work with that Moses isn't doing this alone. Kind of what Jethro had originally told him he should be doing, and God is doing this. Okay, and as far as the food is concerned, God said, Moses, God said he's going to give them something to eat. And he says, should flocks and God, or Moses is saying, there's like 600,000 people on foot. Should flocks and herds also be slaughtered for them to be sufficient for them? Or should all the fish of the sea be gathered up? And the Lord said to Moses, is the Lord's power limited? Now you shall see whether my word will come true or not. Because God said, hey, they're going to eat. They're going to eat meat in the next day. So Moses went out and told the people and gathered the 70 up. And the Lord came down in a cloud and spoke to them. He took the Spirit who was upon them and he placed them upon the 70. And there were a couple guys who weren't there. And Joshua, the son of Nun, came in and told them, hey, there are two that actually didn't come up. I don't know why. They got delayed. But they're out in the people prophesying. And Moses said, that's fine. It's not a problem. And he says in verse 29, would that all the Lord's people were prophets, the Lord would put his Spirit upon them. Joel 2, Acts 2, if you want to write that out, that's kind of interesting. And then, now verse 31, the wind went forth from the Lord and brought quail from the sea and then fall beside the camp, about a day's journey on the side of the day's journey all around the camp, 2 cubits deep. Ladies and gentlemen, that is 36 inches. That is a yardstick of quail and a day's journey all the way around the camp. Where does he say to them, you shall eat meat? Verse 20, but a whole month until it comes. So verse 20 of chapter 11, God says, you're going to eat meat. Oh, you're going to get some meat. But a whole month until it comes out of your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you, because you have rejected the Lord who is among you, and you have wept before me saying, why did we ever leave Egypt? God said, you want it? I'll give it to you. Till it's running out your nose, I'm going to give you meat. And what's interesting here is they gathered up, they as greedily gathered up as much as they could. And so they're gathering it up. Verse 32, the people spent all day, all night, and all the next day. They gathered quail. He who gathered least gathered 10 homers. 10 homers. 1 homer is a donkey load. That's about 6.5 bushels of quail. 10 homers. 10 donkeys carrying quail. The least of the families gathered that much. The least gathered was that much. That is a donkey load of quail. All right? Verse 33, while the meat was still between their teeth, before it was chewed, the anger of the Lord was kindled against the people, and the Lord struck the people with a very severe plague. So the name of the place was called Kiroboth Hata'ava, which means graves of greediness. That's rather explicit, right? And so they're still chewing on this quail that they've, or meat that they wanted. And God said, because you were greedy. Now, God's told them they're going to be having it for a month, right? They're going to be having it. But they went out and spent basically 3 work days gathering as much as they could. What does that say about their trust in God? Very little trust in God. And this won't be the only time. What did they do whenever they got the manna? What happened then? Do you remember? Same thing. God said, gather what you need for the day, and there'll be some tomorrow. Some gathered more, and the worm came and ate it all. So, anyway, it rotted. Chapter 12, very quickly, what God provides in abundance. All right. Chapter 12, Miriam and Aaron murmur. So it's not just that the people murmur. Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman whom he had married, for he had married a Cushite woman. All right, Cushites, Midianites are synonymous. Hebrews or Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 7. According to Jeremiah 12, 33, the Cushites were a dark-skinned people. We don't know necessarily that's the issue, but he married a Cushite woman who's down from there in the Ethiopian, ancient Ethiopian region. And so they murmur. And verse 12, or verse 2 rather, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us as well? All right, we'll stop there. But it's not just that, but there's some jealousy here that we're going to be talking about very quickly next Wednesday. Thank you very much for your time. If you want You can read ahead. That's fine.